On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Ramesh Panuru is young, smart, passionate, and a great bright hope of the American right. At 31, he's a senior editor at the Conservative National Review, published all over, even at his media baptism on Jon Stewart's Daily Show. He's a Kansas wunderkind, Hindu dad, Lutheran mom, graduated high school at 16, Princeton summa cum laude, a Catholic convert on his own volition. Now Ramesh Panuru is out to make his first big mark with his first big book. It's aimed mainly at Democrats, and he's entitled it The Party of Death, The Democrats, The Media, The Courts, and The Disregard for Human Life. It's about abortion, stem cell research. Rush Limbaugh loves it. So does William Bennett. Is this the future of American political debate? Up next on Point, Ramesh Panuru and the Party of Death. Ramesh Panuru joins me from Washington. Thanks so much for being with us.
Glad to be here.
So here, you've really put a fork in it, got people all riled up just with the title, and we want to understand that. We want to understand the argument behind it. But it's so—it's such a red flag. I kind of like to get to know you a little bit better first, Ramesh. Tell us about your background. A Kansas kid, out of high school early and off to Princeton. Give us the Ramesh Panuru bio.
Well, yes, I was born and raised in Kansas City. My parents had moved over to this country just a month or two before I was born.
From India.
From India. Yep. And, yeah, I just grew up on the Kansas side of Kansas City and ended up, went to public schools in KC and then went to Princeton. And I've been on the East Coast ever since, came to D.C., and started working for National Review right after college.
A Hindu father, Lutheran mother, you're now a Catholic. How did that all unfold?
Well, my parents sort of compromised by not raising us with any particular religion. And it was really only in adulthood that I started looking into religious matters seriously. And, I actually was only received into the Catholic Church about 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. And because I'm Catholic and because I'm a pro-lifer, people assume that, I'm pro-life because I'm Catholic. But it's actually the other way around, because I was pro-life long before I became religious and became Catholic.
You're 31 years old, a long career, one suspects, in front of you in politics and publishing and, I don't know, maybe the think tank world. You've chosen to come out of the gates with this title, your first book. You've written a lot, but your first book, The Party of Death. I've read and I see the argument, but I'm just wondering how you chose that. You've taken some ribbing from it already. You were on were brave enough to go in the lion's den with Jon Stewart on The Daily Show. There you were. Maybe let's listen to a bit of that conversation. Here's Stewart asking you about how Americans can talk about emotional issues like abortion, and he ribs you a little bit too.
This is a conversation that clearly America should have openly, but doesn't. And in many respects, and I know that you care very deeply about your issue, but it seems like rhetoric, such as the Party of Death, mm-hmm. puts people on, I guess what I would call, the defensive. In some respects.
Yeah. I have noticed that from time to time.
Okay, on The Daily Show. Party of Death. Why, Ramesh?
Sure. Well, the title was sort of inspired by a liberal political philosopher, legal philosopher, really, Ronald Dworkin, who wrote a book in the mid-90s defending abortion and euthanasia. And the first line of this book is, "Abortion and euthanasia are choices for death." And I thought that was a really arresting phrase and an admirably candid and straightforward way of putting it. And, Dworkin, like other philosophers, goes on to defend abortion and euthanasia as choices for death by saying basically, the unborn child, for example, isn't a person with rights. And what my book is about how people, for various reasons, supported legal abortion. And some of them did so just because they thought abortion was the least bad response to tragic circumstances. But it unleashed the idea that there are human unpersons. And my book is about the spread of that idea, the influence of that idea. I treat the Party of Death as being the people who, like say, Peter Singer, like Ronald Dworkin, believe that there are human unpersons whose lives are expendable. And I treat a lot of other people, you know, who are pro-choice for other reasons, for example, as being sort of the unwitting allies of this party of death.
I want to go into that argument, but let me ask you first, because I'm still just standing here looking at, I mean, William Buckley is blurbing you well here. All the sort of bigs of the conservative pantheon are lining up behind the book. You're 31 years old. You're already senior editor at the National Review. Is this where politics are going in this country? And if, I mean, it's, you know, if you look at it on the surface, it sounds kind of like people who call Republicans Nazis. And then you call Democrats the party of death. And where do we end up with this kind of slam it to the wall? All talk about polarization,
sure.
Party of death, Nazis, fascists. I mean, these are, you may see it in black and white. You know, a lot of people don't. You've been called absolutist around this issue. But,
right.
But is this the way to work it out?
Well, first of all, I would urge people to actually read the book. I mean, even just read the introduction, and you can see how I use the title, how I use this phrase party of death, and it's not meant to be a purely pejorative phrase. It's meant to be, in some ways, a descriptive phrase.
It's not meant to be pejorative.
I'm not saying I'm not purely pejorative. No, there obviously is a pejorative.
There's something laudatory about being a party of death?
Look, here's my point. I'm not saying all of you people on the other side of this debate are evil. What I'm saying is that the objective effect of what you're supporting is undermining the sanctity of human life, is an agenda that says that it's okay to deliberately cause the death of innocent human beings. I don't see how you can make the pro-life case without suggesting that your opponents are in some way abetting a culture of death.
It's just natural that it hasn't been there. Instead of pro-life, pro-choice, it should have been pro-life, pro-death all along. How do you define this party of death? You say it should not be confused with a conventional political party. It has members and opponents within both of America's major political parties. How do you define it?
Well, as I said, the core members of the party of death are those who say that there are human unpersons whose lives are expendable. And, that there are a lot of other people who support, say, abortion or euthanasia for different reasons, and then I describe them as sort of unwitting allies of the party of death, and I talk about how their support, whatever their intentions, helps legitimize an across-the-board devaluation of human life.
Senator Zell Miller, I say bomb the hell out of them. If there's collateral damage, so be it. They certainly found our civilians to be expendable. Party of death?
I do think that's a very... I do think that's an immoral way of looking at the matter. I talk about a very little bit about issues like the war and the death penalty in the book. And the first thing I say about this, I am myself, for example, an opponent of the death penalty, but I don't really treat these topics in great detail for this reason. The argument that I'm concerned about in this book, the idea whose dangerous implications I'm tracing in our culture and our politics and our society, is the idea that there are these human unpersons. And although Zell Miller comes very close in that line you just quoted, I think in general, the most sophisticated defenders of, say, the Iraq War or of the death penalty don't make their argument on the idea that, say, Iraqis or criminals aren't persons with the right to life. They make different kinds of arguments.
National Review editor Rich Lowry, if we flatten part of Damascus or Tehran or whatever it takes, that's part of the solution. Ann Coulter, we carpet bombed German cities, we killed civilians, that's war, and this is war. I mean, the unperson, you're calling Democrats the party of death because they make life into unlife, people into unpersons. Are there not a lot of ways of doing that?
Well, sure. I got chided on the Stewart Show for making this point too. But I mean, I do believe, that certain types of tactics in a war can cross the line and violate pro-life principles. For example, I do think the carpet bombing of cities the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki do amount to the intentional killing of civilians, of innocent human beings, and should not have been allowed.
So does that put Ann Coulter in the party of death?
If she's defending that, it makes her to that extent a supporter of the party of death. Yeah, absolutely.
How's it resonating? Are you just getting?
I should say I've not read. I wasn't familiar with any of the quotes that you just mentioned.
Are you just getting brickbats from? Bouquets and brickbats from either end of the polls here. Have you found some middle ground of resonance? I mean, people do struggle with stem cell research and what does it mean? How far do you go? Third trimester? You know, there is a line at which lots of people struggle. Are you finding that the party of death framing draws them out into a good conversation, or does it send them fleeing for the polls in our famously polarized national dialogue?
Sure. Well, I think that the people who are, say, pro-choice and are willing to read a book from the other point of view are not the kind of people who are put off by a title or a misinterpretation of a title. And so while most of the people who have read the book have been people who are pro-life, and most of the feedback I've gotten has been from pro-lifers, every once in a while I'll get an email or a note from somebody who will say something like, you know, look, I'm pro-choice and I read your book. And I don't agree with all of it, but you did present a thoughtful case, and I at least understand the pro-life case better than I did before.
Of course, the Terri Schiavo case brought a lot of this out in 2005, this very debate. Congress took up the Schiavo case. Passions were running high on both sides of the political aisle. Let's listen here just to be reminded. Here's Republican Congressman James Sensenbrenner of Wisconsin.
In our deeds and in our public actions, we must build a culture of life that welcomes and defends all human life. The compassionate traditions and highest values of our country command us to action.
Democratic Congressman John Lewis of Georgia had a different take on Congress's role in the Schiavo case.
The Florida courts have spoken, and we should not intervene. This is a very, very sad night for the House of Representatives. Mr. Speaker, is it possible for us to let this young woman take her leave in peace?
We've got a big podium, hotshot young conservative with us. He wants to call the Democrats the party of death. What do you think? 800-423-TALK. Phil is calling from Sumter, South Carolina. Hi, Phil. You're on the air.
Yes. Good morning. How are you?
Very well. What do you know, Phil?
Well, a couple of things. George Bush, when he was governor, talked about the electric couch instead of the electric chair. I need to know if this gentleman thinks that he is part of the party of life or the party of death.
The electric couch, as in line them up and get a lot of folks on there.
Yes, sir. Yes, mm-hmm. sir. Mm-hmm. The death penalty. And secondly, having served in the legislative body for a number of years, I argued passionately against the death penalty for multiple child sex offenders. And there was a group outside protesting abortion, but not joining me in the argument against the death penalty for multiple child sex offenders. I think life without parole could do it. So those two things, and one last comment.
Mm-hmm.
Would the young man advocate liberal spending, yes, the L word, for children born because he opposed the value, he imposed his values upon someone else?
Phil, stick with us. Ramesh Panur, how do you respond on the death penalty, on support for those babies that might be born? Are you willing to support them with public welfare?
Sure. First things first, on the death penalty, I applaud this, I guess, former legislator stance. I think the death penalty should be abolished. And there are, in fact, quite a few pro-lifers who take that position.
So do you say President Bush is in the party of death then, in his support of it?
No, because, I mean, as I said, I mean, I'm using the party of death in a, you know, to refer to people who are supporting this idea that there are sort of human unpersons. And it's just a different kind of argument. It raises different moral issues.
Does it really? I mean, are you just using it in a partisan way if you apply it here but not there?
Well, I mean, I suppose that would be true if I were criticizing Democratic pro-choicers but not criticizing Republican pro-choicers. Mm. But that's not true. I do criticize Republicans in a number of places in the book, as you mentioned yourself. Secondly, on this question of governmental support for children, for mothers with in difficult circumstances, I do have a chapter where I go into this. I say that there's no reason in principle that conservatives and pro-lifers shouldn't support governmental efforts to help families in difficult circumstances. But there are practical, legitimate areas for practical debate about what the best way to help people is. I mean, in fact, you know, if you go back 10 years, there were people who argued that, you know, to help poor families and single mothers, we needed to keep the welfare system as it was, and there were people who said we needed to reform it. And
such as Bill Clinton, who wanted to reform it.
That,
yep.
Clinton was one of them, mm-hmm, yes. And and I think the balance of evidence suggests that Clinton and the Republican Congress were right, that that the best way to help families in these situations was to reform welfare. And incidentally, people said at the time, some of them, that the abortion rate would rise when they did that because you would be reducing support for single mothers. And it didn't happen. The abortion rate declined.
Phil, I think it's Phil Leventis in Sumter, South Carolina. How about it? Ramesh says, yes, indeed, the death penalty is not right. And he's happy to see conservatives, Republicans, supporting people who need support.
Well, I appreciate his answer and respect it a great deal, but I'm still in the legislature, and I don't see that happening as a practical matter. I see great pushback on any support for young people, whether they're born to in difficult circumstances or not so difficult circumstances. And so I have concern. The argument that I made was last month, and the result was that South Carolina did pass a death penalty for multiple child sex offenders, and I was disappointed.
You're a Democrat. Do you see yourself as belonging to the party of death?
No, and I respect the young man for being quite clear about the fact that he's not talking about a political party.
But well, but he says it's heavily weighted toward Democrats. I mean, it's right in his subtitle. He says the Democrats.
Right. Well, I did not realize that, but the point is that when he says what he says, it's clear implication, I did not know about the subtitle, that we are talking about one political party as opposed to another. And it was the young Republicans who pushed strongly on the death penalty, and the older Democrats, myself, who pushed against it. But that's one special issue which I wanted to comment on.
We hear it, and we appreciate your raising it, Phil. Thank you very much for calling in from South Carolina. Let me get a call from Orange County, California. Dave's on the line. Hi, Dave. You're on the air.
Hello. I would suggest 2 points that while Ramesh is obviously a very intelligent young man, being a young man is easier to see things in black and white. And as you grow older and more experienced, things start to become a little less black and white. And also that his argument is fairly convenient in his isolation of abortion away from the death penalty. It's easy to say abortion is bad, but any other type of killing is just fine, and to put a new label on people as, what is he calling them, unhumans?
Unpersons.
Too convenient.
Ramesh Panuru, pick it up. What do you make of it? I mean, your age is interesting here because it does mean certain things about life experience, but also because it means you have, we hope for you, a long career ahead of you. Dave says, you're still too young. You're seeing things in such an absolute terms. Life is more complicated than that. How do you respond to that view?
Well, I mean, I think that the age thing is sort of a red herring. I mean, there are people who agree with me, you know, who are much older and much younger. Interestingly enough, the public opinion polling nowadays seems to suggest that people over 65 and people younger than 35 are the most likely to be pro-life, and that it's the people in between, sort of the boomers, who are more on the other side of the debate. As for this question of convenience, well, let me just say flat out, I mean, I think that the death penalty is wrong and immoral, but I don't think that it is as unjust as abortion is, because, you know, abortion is the killing of an innocent human life. I think it's a much graver kind of injustice. And, you know, I mean, you can disagree with my substantive point of view in that ranking of the moral issues, but you can't just say that because it tends to help people who agree with me on that set of moral priorities, that it's therefore convenient.
Ramesh, stand by if you'd be good enough. Ramesh Panuru is with us from Washington. Also with us now from Washington is Neera Tanden. She's Senior Vice President at the Center for American Progress. From 2003 to 2005, she served as Legislative Director for Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton and was Deputy Campaign Manager for Clinton's Senate race. She was a Senior Policy Advisor to then First Lady Hillary Clinton. Neera Tanden, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks. Great to be with you.
Give us some perspective from your seat here. You've sat pretty close to Hillary Clinton there. She's carving out a quite interesting position on abortion lately. We'll come to that. But first, how do you see Ramesh Panuru and the party of death label? How's this work? What do you read in it?
Well, I think it's a bit disingenuous. I think the concern here is that I respect the deep concern Mr. Pinheiro has for his position, but what I found sort of disturbing about this book was that he wasn't willing to understand or even discuss that other people on the other side of this have a moral claim on this issue as well, and that of course they object to the term party of death, but there is a view on this. I mean, he basically says this is just about human life, and abortion is murder. And there are millions of Americans who believe that a fetus at 3 weeks or 2 weeks or a week does not have the same status as a 7-year-old or a mother or a 42-year-old, and yet he completely equates these two things.
So do you see a religious point of view being imposed on the pro-choice crowd here or something else?
Well, I take him at his word that this is just his moral position. And it doesn't need to, it might have, some people have this view from a religious perspective, but it doesn't necessarily need to be a religious perspective. I just make the claim that people of good faith, of with moral principles, can have a different view, which is that the fetus is not, a 3-week-old fetus does not have the same moral standing or the same rights as a 5-year-old child or a 27-year-old woman, and that this is a legitimate view. And millions of Americans share it. And by using the language of party of death, and again, this language which really attacks people of a different perspective, I do believe that he is making this conversation much more difficult. And I think it's a little unfair to have this terminology.
Ramesh Pinheiro, New York Times has worked a lot with Hillary Clinton. You pay a lot of attention to Hillary Clinton in your book. You say, in fact, that Hillary Clinton could ride the abortion issue to the White House. Describe that flight path for us.
Sure. Well, I talk about what it might look like if Hillary Clinton were to actually follow through on her stated intention of finding common ground and reaching out to pro-lifers, and how if she did that, it would cause a lot of people who have left the Democratic Party over the last generation to really give it a serious second look.
And she's been doing that, at least rhetorically, she's been doing that very strongly, saying we want to make this as possible, right? Rhetorically, she's been there already.
No, I disagree with that, actually.
Oh.
For one thing...
Safe, legal, and rare, and, just rare as possibly can be. I mean, she's taking that just about as far as you can in a speech.
Okay, let me make two points about that. First, whether this is actually common ground, and secondly, just even just looking at the rhetoric. When you have somebody who has favored taxpayer-funded abortion, who has voted for partial birth abortion, who is co-sponsoring legislation that includes legalization of effectively all late-term abortions, that's not a common ground set of positions. That's not a consensus set of positions. And then, and then also the opposition to parental consent. Even rhetorically, all of these speeches which Hillary Clinton has been giving from 1999 onward, which are praised in the press for their supposed moderation, she compares pro-lifers to the communist dictators of China and Romania. It seems to me
about how government can get in the business of controlling sexual behavior, I guess. Is that where she brings in China and Romania?
She says that if you allow restrictions on reproductive rights, next thing you know, this is going to be like communist China or communist Romania, where people are being forced to have abortions and so forth.
That's not at all accurate. I mean, I'm sorry.
That's in every single speech, and the only point of that is demonization. Everybody's attacking me for the title of my book and giving her plaudits for the supposedly moderate rhetoric. And it seems to me that when the front runner for the Democratic nomination says this kind of thing, it's rather more important than a misinterpretation of the title of my book.
Neera Tanden, how about it? How do you see Hillary Clinton's view of abortion intersecting with Ramesh Pinheiro's party of death framing?
Let me just say, I'm not here to, be Hillary Clinton's spokesperson in this regard. Let me just say, when Hillary has talked about what's happened in Romania and China, her simple point is that you know, it's a simple point about her beliefs. Her beliefs on abortion are animated by her experience of visiting government regulation, seeing the effects of government regulation of reproductive rights in two extremes. She does not say, she never has said in her life, and it is complete exaggeration and really misinformation to say that pro-life people want to take us to Romania or China. You can never find that because she has never said it. What she has said is her experience in those countries have shaped her views that government does not have a role in these decisions because it can lead to a slippery slope one way or the other. She's never in her life said that people who are pro-life are wrong or evil or communist dictators one way or the other. You can never find that because it does not exist. And I think
Neera's being disingenuous here.
I'm sorry, Ramesh. I think that level of discussion shows exactly what kind of book this is, which is it is a hit piece. It's not a book that is meant to have a serious discussion. I understand that. I mean, I take you at your word that it comes from a strong philosophical position of yours. But
okay, now, Neera, you said earlier in this discussion.
I'm sorry, can I just finish?
No. You've said specific things about me that I've left unchallenged here. You say, for example, that I call abortion murder in my book. If you'd actually read the book, you would see that there is not a single page of my book in which I say any such thing. And you
But it's wrongful death, clearly.
Yeah, but you yourself have just explained that, you know, oh, well, no, she's not saying pro-lifers are like communist dictators. They would just put us on a slippery slope towards communist dictatorship. That's all I'm saying. There's nothing disingenuous about it. You are just unused to Hillary Clinton getting criticized for this disingenuous, sloppy rhetoric
because
of hers.
You're wrong. I mean, I'm not objecting to, if you were right, I wouldn't object. But the fact is she's not saying, she's talking about what has made her come to her position on this issue. Not that
the only point of that, the
way,
only point of
Ramesh, let me ask you a point of fact, Ramesh. What about the South Dakota move on Roe v. Wade? Do you favor outlawing all abortion, even in cases of rape and incest?
First of all, I just want to lay us out on the table. I do not believe that Neera Tanden has read my book, which she is criticizing as a hit piece.
I read the whole book.
Number two, do you
support abortion in cases of rape and incest, or you oppose it?
What I argue in my book is that we should have a legislative debate where we try to build a consensus. Let me finish my answer to this question. I do not believe that it is at all likely or possible that we are going to build a consensus that says that abortion should be restricted even in the cases of rape and incest.
I want to get another perspective on this, if I may. Joining us from Boston, George Annis, bioethicist, chair of the Department of Health Law, Bioethics, and Human Rights at Boston University School of Public Health. He's author of American Bioethics. George Annis, thank you very much for joining us.
Happy to be here, Tom.
So here are Americans looking out at all the headlines and all the news. The abortion headlines have been there forever. Terry Schiavo and the right to die, more recent, and now stem cell. People want to do the right thing. They want to feel they're on the side of, you know, wise, humane right here. Ramesh Panuru says we've got a party of death at work. How do you look at that as a bioethicist?
Well, I think the abortion debate is virtually intractable in the United States and always has been. But I think that the attempt to enlarge the abortion debate into debates at the end of life, like Terry Schiavo and stem cells, has already shown that it can't be done and that the American public is disgusted with this. And we won't solve abortion, but even Bill Frist, after the Terry Schiavo, reflected on that just a couple months ago, was asked what lesson he learned from the Schiavo debacle. And he said the lesson he learned, and I quote him, is that the American people don't want the United States Senate to get involved in individual cases. And he's exactly right. To most Americans, we're talking about medical decisions that should be made in the doctor-patient relationship, should be private. If the person is incompetent, should be family decisions. Politicians, the government, should not be involved.
But Ramesh Panuru says we've just kind of slid into that position through decades of moral laxity. You're a bioethicist. Is it defensible?
Nonsense. I don't know what books he's reading, but we haven't slid.
He's writing them now, George.
We've been debating this position since before he was born. The Supreme Court decision in Roe v. Wade is 1973, I think, before he was born. So the idea that we haven't been debating these issues for a long time is just simply not true.
But stem cell research is new.
We've come to a consensus on stem cell research. Virtually every poll shows Americans want stem cell research to go ahead. California is funding it to the tune of $3 billion by a public referendum. These are not private decisions that are made in some back rooms. These are publicly debated decisions that Americans have come down on, and come down on very strongly. Nobody wants Congress to make decisions about their relatives, whether or not they should continue to be fed, even though they have no brain function left. I mean, that's just, I don't know where the debate is on that.
Ramesh, let's look at stem cells. Do you think Americans are being foolish, morally lax in their openness to stem cell research?
Well, again, a phrase that morally lax that I don't use.
I'm asking you if you think Americans
are
being...
I know, but, you know, since this is...
It's not words in your mouth. I'm simply asking you. I'm simply asking.
Look, I don't think it's true that there's a national consensus on stem cells. And in fact, the polling is split on this. When the polling talks about funding on research that destroys human embryos at fertility clinics, the so-called spare or leftover embryos, the public supports that. But when they're talking about creating embryos for the purpose of these experiments through cloning, the polling's very strongly against it, has consistently been strongly against that. And that, I think, is really what a lot of the coming fight is about, not about these fertility clinic embryos, but about cloned human embryos. And there's a reason why its advocates have, over the last 2.5 years, stopped using the word cloning because they know it's unpopular and they're running away from it.
George, there must be, you're a bioethicist. There are lines here that, as an ethicist, you must not want the country to cross.
Of course there are lines. They're very important lines. I mean, I think that it's certainly one thing to, for example, to clone an embryo to make medicine, and another totally different thing to try to make a baby. I don't countenance that, and don't think anyone should do that. It's one thing to refuse medical treatment, even if the consequences is you're going to die. It's another thing to actually kill a human being.
But what about cloning to create tissue for medical treatment?
I have no problem with that. I don't think, you know, that was a California referendum. The Californians voted overwhelmingly to approve a constitutional amendment to permit exactly that, cloning to make a human embryo to use to make medicine. That I really don't think there's a big debate about that. Cloning is a word that people associate primarily with making a baby, and people don't want us to do that, and I don't want to do it. I think they're absolutely right about that. It's a misunderstanding in the polls when people say that they don't want to use a stem cell research.
But Ramesh would effectively say that the cloned embryo is a baby, or will be.
Well, it's certainly not a baby. I mean, as my colleague Leonard Glantz pointed out 20 years ago, if you had a burning infertility clinic and in one corner are 8 embryos and in the other corner is a baby, no one in their right mind would do anything but save the baby if they couldn't save both the embryos and the baby. It's not a baby. It will be a baby if it's properly, you know, if it's gestated by a woman for 9 months and who gives birth to it. But it's certainly not a baby in its current form. And it doesn't have the moral import of a baby. Anyone who makes the argument that it does would have to save those 8 embryos and let the baby, the real live human baby, burn to death.
George Annis, author of American Bioethics, I want to thank you for being with us.
Sure,
thanks very much for joining
you,
us.
Thanks.
I explicitly take on that burning fertility clinic argument as a bad analogy in my book. But let me just say, the polls on cloning do not depend on misunderstanding of the word cloning. In fact, if you simply if you don't use the word cloning, but say, should we be creating human embryos for the purposes of experiments that destroy them, that too gets public opposition in the polls. I mean, this guy can't say, there's a national consensus in favor of this, and then point to one vote in one state as evidence of his national consensus when all of the polls nationally point the other way. And California is a more socially liberal state.
Pretty big state. Ramesh Nira, lots of listeners want to join the conversation. Let me turn to some from Cedar Falls, Iowa. Raul is on the air. Hi, Raul.
Hi. Hi, Ramesh. I just have a small question from you. I'm actually from India, and I'm a Hindu. And I just wanted to know exactly what aspect of your upbringing has made you think in such a polarized black and white manner about just one particular party and issues such as abortion.
Are you saying that Hindu culture is more tolerant along these lines, Raul?
I'm not really saying that Hindu culture is more tolerant. It's just that Hindu upbringing has made me think in different manners. It's just that what may be right for me is not necessarily right for somebody else. And if you just be a little bit more patient, you might be able to see somebody else's point of view.
Ramesh?
Well, okay, you know, again, let's talk about that. You know, look, I mean, you have to read three pages in my book to see that I explicitly say that other points of view on this are legitimate, but I'm going to go on to explain why I disagree with them and why I hope that my readers will come to disagree with them. I mean, so this idea that you know, my book is just one long attack is just not
the party of death. I mean, it starts off with a pretty big billboard marquee there. But anyway, what about Raoul's question?
Look, I mean, God, Tom, you have not looked past this title the entire hour we've been on this show.
It's on the front of the... You know, I mean, I'm looking inside. I see that you mean it. You say you mean it in love. Nevertheless, you know, I mean, I was in Rwanda when the Tutsis were called cockroaches, and the next thing we knew, they were killed. You know, labels that we hang on people
genocide,
do matter, right?
Genocide does count as being part of the party of death.
Talk about unpersoning. You make a party that represents about half the country the party of death. And isn't that a kind of unpersoning in itself?
No, that's absurd. I mean, first of all, I didn't say that half the country is the party of death. I mean, that's the whole point of saying that they're unwitting allies. I mean, I specifically say it's more when I'm talking about the party of death, I'm talking about people like Ron Dworkin and Peter Singer, people who explicitly say that these are human unpersons. They don't have the status of human beings and we can kill them. I mean, the same sort of thing, frankly, that Neera Tanden was saying.
But what about the sort of call for tolerance?
Same sort of thing that John Kerry said in 2004.
Yeah.
It's a human being, but it's not a person, so it's okay to kill it.
And Raoul's point saying, hey, Brother Ramesh, what about some more tolerance here? Do you think that's just morally
okay? What is the
elastic
classic slogan,
too elastic?
The classic slogan of tolerance is live and let live, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's what I'm arguing for. We have to tolerate the continued life of beings that we might find it convenient to kill. Now, it's one thing to say, you know, we should tolerate one another's differences in religion, differences in sexual morality, differences in taste. But you can't say that we should tolerate one another's different views on who we can kill. I mean, no government can proceed on that assumption. Either the government is going to have to take a position that says either it is permissible to kill these classes of human beings or it is not. And I'm making the argument for why it should not be.
Of course, the nations come to a kind of consensus. Neera, please.
I'm sorry. What I don't understand about this is that you argue in several pages, specifically when you talk about a speech about Hillary Clinton could give, sort of a dream speech you have, you make an exception for imprisoning women. And I don't actually understand that if it is the killing of a human life, if your view is if you believe actually that a 5-week-old fetus or a 2-week-old fetus is a human being entitled to similar, if not the same, rights as a woman or a 7-year-old, then why wouldn't a woman, why is it acceptable that a woman should not, why the woman should not go to jail? I mean, why is that even remotely possible? Otherwise, if she shouldn't go to jail, then you're really saying yourself that it's not the same status as a human, like an adult.
Ramesh?
Well, thank you for flipping through a few pages of the book. It does actually go on to explain this exact point that you are making. Two things. First of all, traditionally American law did not punish the pregnant woman who was seeking an abortion.
But that doesn't need to have standing for the future.
Number two, as I explain in the book, in the construction of a just legal order, both the objective and the subjective moral elements of a crime are worth mentioning. I mean, when we punish manslaughter differently than we punish, you know, first-degree murder, for example, we're not saying that the person killed in manslaughter has less of a right than the person killed in first-degree murder. The legislature is simply making determinations about degrees of culpability and so forth. Are you going to actually let me finish my answer,
Mira? Go ahead.
The equality that I have in mind between an unborn child, for example, and a 1-year-old is simply the equality in having a right not to be killed. Doesn't mean that, for example, the person who kills the unborn child, say the abortionist, has to be treated the same way as somebody who kills a business rival out of greed. The subjective moral elements aren't there. And that can legitimately and morally, I think, be taken into account when you're making decisions about punishment and prohibition.
Ramesh Nair, if I may, I think we got the heart of that. I want to get a couple more callers here, if we could. There's only been waiting. Richard's calling from Buffalo, New York. Hi, Richard. You're on the air.
Thank you. Congratulations on your book, Mr. Panura. I haven't bought it yet, but I'm going to go out right out and buy it. I take the approach that Roe versus Wade frontally assaults basic constitutional protections. And I congratulate the pro-choice side in trying to separate the two. Look at what Justice Blackmun said. We need not resolve the difficult question of when life begins. Well, we all know when life begins. And in fact, if you read Judge Noonan's book, A Private Choice, but written about 30 years ago, you can see that even the medical community agreed, a new ethic for society and medicine agreed that life begins at conception, but that they said they had to lie about it to deceive a gullible public.
Richard, so you're a smart guy. Let me ask you something here. Do you think Ramesh's approach here pushes us closer to a national resolution on this? Do we need to kind of, draw a thick black line and then duke it out until one side or the other wins, the party of death is defeated?
Well, no. I think we have to discuss it much more openly. We have to discuss all the faked maternal death rates due to illegal abortion, which has been disputed in an article in the American Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology in 1967 by Dr. Alex Barno. I think we have to have the news media has to have a new integrity, which it has not shown.
And this is the way to frame it? You think this will take us there?
Well, I think it's probably necessary to say some of these things so that you can really really discuss it. I'd be willing to debate. For example, I regard stem cell research, not embryonic stem cell research, mm-hmm. as a form of medical cannibalism.
Okay, we got it, and we hear it, and we hear that you're ready to debate. I want to get one more caller, if I may. John's calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, John, you're on the air.
Hi. I had a question for Ramesh, and I first want to say I do appreciate his great concern, his ethical concern for mm-hmm. protecting human life.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering how conservatives would apply this great, deep ethical concern to environmental issues. I think the greatest risk that we are facing in regard to human life is global warming and the degradation of our environment. I think we are facing some serious risks to human life. I want to know the conservative point of view on the ethical choice here.
Ramesh, are you ready to ride your ethics right onto that issue, embrace it as well?
Sure. I think that an ethical approach to the environment, and also there's many other issues, healthcare being another prominent one, that we do have to come up with the policies that are going to help human flourishing. That includes being protected from environmental risks, from health risks, and so on and so forth.
What's the party of death in those venues?
There's a disagreement about, sort of how best to do those things. But in addition, none of those things rise to the level of the injustice of deliberately targeting classes of human being and saying that their lives are expendable.
What about targeting all human beings? Is that less a threat to life?
Well, I mean, look, if somebody were to say, hey, it's okay to risk the destruction of the entire human race, well, obviously that would be, a bad position to take.
People make the case that we are risking that, right?
War debates. I mean, there are prudential arguments of a sort that aren't in play when one makes the principled argument that unborn human life doesn't have moral status and can be killed with impunity.
Nir Tandon, is this going to work? Will it be pro-life and pro-death in the next great chapter of our American debate here?
Well, I hope not. I mean, I hope that we can have a real discussion on both sides and have a discussion of, it's hard to have an honest discussion about these issues when one side is calling the other the party of death. And I don't think we can do that, and I don't think this helps. And I think elements throughout this book, I think talking about Terri Schiavo's situation and just describing it, as euthanasia, which I think a lot of people think would make the distinction between euthanasia and a person choosing to, if they come into a certain life circumstance, not continue to live artificially.
We hear it. You say thanks, but no thanks. Nir Tandon, we're out of time. Senior Vice President at the Center for American Progress, thanks for joining us. Ramesh, you're out of the gates with your book here. What's your next title, my friend?
I am not going to write another book for quite some time, I think.
Well, you put a big stick to the wasp nest here, and we admire your standing up with gusto, Ramesh Panuru. The book is The Party of Death. Thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.